Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast. It is September 2022. Can you believe it? I don't know where time's going. Now, I've got a wonderful guest for you today. We've got Sue Baker. She is an executive coach working with leaders in large organisations at board level. She's been a coach for 20 years, well, over 20 years. And full disclosure, she's actually my coach. So when you are working in this space and all about personal development and self-improvement, the work never stops. And it's really important that if you are working as a coach, you actually also have a coach. So I've done a lot of work with Sue over the last year. She's a brilliant lady, really knowledgeable, really great at pushing you to do the reflection. I thoroughly enjoyed my coaching with her. So in today's conversation, we thought we'd ask Sue all about the questions on why somebody should get a coach, what you should be looking for in a coach, what are the trends we're seeing in coaching, and what are some of the things that senior leaders tend to come to coaches to work on. It's a really insightful and informative conversation. Like I said, we're in September. It's a great kind of new school year kind of feel, kind of vibe. It might be a great time if you're a leader working in a large organisation to stop, take stock, and think about how an executive coach can help change the way you live and lead. I'd highly recommend Sue if you are looking for somebody. Likewise, John and I are always available for coaching too. Now over to the conversation.
We are joined by Sue Baker, and a coach just like Rachel and I. So we're absolutely delighted to have you on the podcast today, Sue. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
How long have you been doing this? Has this been a thing that you've been doing for your whole career, or is it something that you've found a bit later on? Tell us how you started this whole thing.
I was one of those annoyingly lucky people who found something that they wanted to do really early in their career. So I did a business degree. I had a year out working with Fujitsu in HR, and I realized really quickly that I didn't want to be an HR person. I wanted to be a leadership development person. So I had a corporate career with Fujitsu. I worked with Bass, the brewer, and then I worked with Norweb, just as Norweb got taken over by Northwest Water and formed a multi-utility company. And after 10 years, realised that there was an opportunity to do something for myself. So the Natalie named Sue Baker Consulting was formed. And that was always a balance between coaching and consulting.
And Sue, just on that, you know, we talk about this and coaching and all this stuff, you know, that we're all very familiar with today, but how long ago was this? And I think the reason why we've invited you on the podcast is you have been involved in coaching since it's become popular in the workplace, and you've kind of grown your businesses as coaching has transformed and emerged in the corporate world. So talk us through that journey in terms of time stamps, if you like.
Yeah, so I think even in my corporate career, I was in L&D, organization development type roles, and was being asked to have conversations with people around shifting their style, or have conversations with people around how they could lead their team. And it wasn't called coaching then, but actually it was. And I didn't, by the way, have any of the frameworks then, or, you know, the tools really. But I think there was an awareness of the need for different behaviours in a workplace. And there was an insight into the power that coaching could have in terms of shifting behaviours. You know, and then on from that, you know, I actually remember I worked with somebody who had been a consultant to me. So I was her client in a corporate setting. And she asked me to go and do a coaching piece of work with a housing association, actually. And I said, but I haven't done coaching. She said, you do coaching all the time, Sue. but I didn't have, you know, I didn't have that process. So, you know, certainly in the earlier days of running my own business, one of the things that I worked quite hard to do was to develop that framework, was to think about, well, what is my process, and to get some qualifications just to give me the credibility, but also to give me a kind of a conceptual framework by which to kind of work. And now, you know, anybody can call themselves a coach. And, you know, I read some articles last week around, you know, the future of coaching. And, you know, of course, all of the coaching bodies are saying people will be accredited in the future. And it's like, yeah, but you've been saying that for 20 odd years, and still anybody can really call themselves a coach. And some are good, and some aren't so good.
Yeah, and I think from my experience, Sue, it doesn't necessarily mean that because you're credited that you are a brilliant, fantastic coach. I know plenty of people who aren't, and I know plenty of people who are, and it is a bit of a mixed bag. Yeah. But here you are now working for yourself. Mm. And the thing that was jumping out at me when you were talking about being in leadership development is that when you're working in an organization, I think you could become quite, it's not easy to be independent when you're working for an organization in the way that allows your coachee to feel comfortable, I think, about coming and talking to somebody who is actually employed by the same people that they're employed by. I just wondered what your thoughts were on that, on actually the value of having an independent coach come into an organization, more for the benefit of the coachee than anybody else, because they then feel a little bit more comfortable. There's no agenda, that sort of thing.
I think the benefit's enormous. And it isn't necessarily about skill. It is about agenda. And it is about coming to a coaching conversation with an individual and accepting them for where they are and what their priorities are and what their strengths are and what they want to work on, rather than coming from with a really clear organizational steer around, you know, Dave needs to become a better leader, or Sue needs to learn how to engage her team more than she currently does. Because the boundaries are just much clearer when you're in external than when you're in internal. You may have the same skills, but the boundaries are really different.
Yeah, I think that's...
I do think there's still enormous benefit. Yeah.
So be thinking about boundaries as a leadership development person in an organization, if you're wanting to employ coaches to help the people that are working in there. Yeah. Mm.
I think that's an interesting point, because it sounds to me, Sue, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you were an internal coach before you knew you were a coach.
Yeah.
and I think nothing's ever black and white, is it? And I think a lot of people, it's a nice lead into coaching for people to be first introduced to it with an internal coach. I'm thinking about my own experience. I worked for an organisation, Vodafone, and I had not heard of external coaching, and they had internal coaches, and I thought it was the best thing since sliced bread. Mm. Now, if I'd have known then what I'd have known now, I'd have probably seen there was a little bit of an agenda wrapped around that. Mm. But at the time, it was mind-blowing for me as the coachee, and that led me... to get really quite an insatiable appetite and curiosity around coaching and the power that it had. And it was almost the start of my journey. And I'm reflecting back on a couple of the people that were in HR that coached me. I think if you're an amazing coach, it doesn't matter if you're internal or external, because like John said, you're capable of holding up those boundaries. But I think if you're caught up in the politics of the organization, it's easy to have a different agenda when you're internal, and that sometimes doesn't put the coachee at the center of it. I've then been in another organization an internal coach, you know, and I've tried to keep those boundaries, but it's very difficult to be impartial when you know the system in which somebody operates, especially if they're not being treated fairly. And I think the other danger, and again, I didn't appreciate your view on this, is when an internal coach is available, I think it's an easy get out for management that perhaps needs leadership help versus the coachee needing the help. You know, it's easier to ask an internal coach to work with this person than for the leader to actually work on their skills to have that difficult conversation. What's been your experience and view on that?
I guess there's two or three things going through my head as I listen to you talk. So the first thing in my head is external coaching can be expensive for organizations. So why would they not try and develop internal coaches? And you know, I believe that's a good thing. I think coaching as a leadership style is something that all organizations benefit from. So I think there is a place for internal coaches is kind of the first thing. And I think organizations looking to develop coaching skills and coaching mindsets are doing the right thing. The second thing I'd say, though, is inevitably when an external coach comes in and when you do that contracting and you're clear about what you bring and what you don't bring, as a coachee, you're in a safer place. It's a safer environment. The coach doesn't have an agenda. Yes, there's a contract at the outset in terms of what we're working on, but there isn't the conflict of interests that often exist with internal coaches. And I suppose the third thing that I'd say is, for me, another huge benefit of external coaches is just the different experience they bring. So, you know, today I've had two calls this morning with Swiss Pharmaceutical that I'm working with. I'm talking to you now. This afternoon, I'm going in and doing some work with an organization in Manchester run by an entrepreneur. Tomorrow morning, I'm working with a French health and safety company. And so all of that experience comes to bear in my coaching. Whereas with an internal coach, they have the experience that they are experiencing in the environment that they're in that organization. So it's just different.
Yeah, that's a really nice way of putting it. And there's probably just one other thing that I'm thinking as you're speaking is the investment that it just shows that the organization is making in that person.
Yeah.
Have tremendous impact on their agency, their feeling of self-worth, and that they're valued, and I don't think we should underestimate that either.
No, I think symbolically it sends a very powerful message to people, and retention is such a big issue these days. I think some organizations almost overplay that, and coaching is almost seen as a tool to aid retention sometimes rather than really a developmental opportunity. I think it has, you know, I think some organizations have used that a bit. But yeah, I think there is a very symbolic value in coaching, in communicating to people that this organization believes in you and sees you as having potential and sees you as somebody who is worthy of investment.
So that is a lovely segue into the different types of coaching and perhaps your view on how you've seen coaching change across organizations in the last 20 years. So just for our listeners that are new to coaching, that perhaps are interested in coaching but haven't had it before, when we say words like developmental coaching or coaching for retention or growth, what do you mean? And how have you seen and observed that change in the last 20 years and particularly for the last 2 years?
Okay, so I guess 20 years ago, coaching or executive coaching was the preserve of senior executives in organisations. In that, you know, it does represent an investment, and it tended to be used at that level in organisation. I think increasingly, coaching is becoming more accessible at different levels, hierarchical levels in organization, and in different ways. So, you know, increasingly before COVID, I was being asked to work with teams. So operating almost as a team coach. So coming in and working with a group of people rather than just one individual, that would be a change. I think another change has been coaching further down the organization, maybe coaching high potentials, maybe coaching people who are at transition points in their career. So potentially taking on a bigger, broader role, that kind of transition coaching. And then I think there's also opportunities to coach small groups. So I'm doing a piece of work tomorrow with an organization, and there's four groups of five people, and we're in a coaching journey. I hate that word, but you know, we're in a coaching journey with those five people, and actually they learn from each other's experiences on that coaching call. And then I think the last thing that I'd say is increasingly, I think organizations are realizing the benefit of coaching being embedded into programs. So I'm doing some work at the moment with an energy supplier who have asked coaches to work in the moment with groups, to observe them on a program and work in the moment with them, which is really powerful in terms of they're in a learning environment, they've got nothing to lose. But as a coach, and particularly with the joys of team and Zoom, you can sit and observe somebody or a group, and then at the end of the day, do a kind of an after action review and say, how do you think that went? And then do a bit of one-to-one as well. And that's really powerful.
That's amazing. It's interesting, John, and I have just responded to a brief very similar to that, where an organization is implementing agile working. So they're going to value stream teams, and the CEO wants people to come in and observe how that team is structuring their objectives and KPIs. And listening to how you articulated it, then I'm thinking, if I was a leader in that organization, to just have somebody independent observe the power structures, what's been said, what's not been said, the levels of curiosity, the quality of questions that have been asked, how quickly the team make decisions, is there any coercive behaviour, how cohesive are they? What a wonderful gift to have in the moment for if you are a learning organisation.
And actually, I think doing that virtually works really beautifully well. You know, so I observed this group of six people going through a 3-day program, and for most of the time they forgot I was there because my camera was off and my sound was off. You know, I had pages and pages of notes on all of them, but you know, they didn't see me taking notes. So I think that is a real gift for people.
And that's like constant feedback, really, for them, isn't it?
Yeah, that's really interesting way of looking at it, Sue. I've just been thinking about somebody who I know has just taken on a new role, and they've been telling me about their day and what's been going on for them. And you can't help it, can you? As a coach, I'm thinking about how that one action that person has taken, it's given me a pretty good feeling for what the culture of that organization is. It's like, you know, how inclusive are people in that company? How much do they value the new starter? Have they got all the processes in place to onboard them properly? And I've just found myself doing exactly what you're doing, almost like, I'm not in the room, but I'm picking up on all these things that are going on. So, and I found that quite, the person that I'm talking about has found that quite useful in the questions that I'm asking them on the basis of what they're telling me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that piece about, you know, being able to really hear what's going on one hand, and at the same time being genuinely curious about their response to that, what happened, how could they have done it differently, what do they think their impact was. You know, holding both of those things together for me is when coaching works really well.
Yeah, I absolutely. And I think the thing is that I've learned over the years is like to challenge my own assumptions about what am I thinking? Have I got into almost like solution mode already for them? And so you've got your own ideas, and I don't think any of us can help that. But it's not saying that, and it's asking the question that challenges your own assumptions, which gets them to think about, actually, John, this happened. And you're like, right, okay. So I would have been going down the wrong road if I'd have made that assumption.
Yeah.
And I think that's so difficult at times.
There's a tension there, isn't there, that I think. I mean, and I would say of myself, certainly in the earlier days of coaching, it was a trap that I fell into, in that you're kind of aware that people are investing in you, you know, so people are paying my invoices on a monthly basis. So there's a temptation to go into solutionizing. There's a temptation to come up with answers for people. There's a temptation to try too hard to make a difference. And I think, you know, years of experience and self-awareness and the piece that you just said about challenging yourself around the assumptions that you're making is really important. And what I would say is that one of the things that really helped me manage all of that was getting a coaching supervisor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I realized that actually there were patterns in almost every coaching relationship I had. And when he challenged me on that, that was my stuff. It wasn't that they all had similar stories. It was that I was projecting stuff into each one of those coaching relationships.
Yeah, it's that trap of falling into. I think it is about providing solutions. But you quickly want to do it, and you want to give back value, I think, in terms of what you're saying around people paying your invoices. And sometimes you can have coaches who are not giving you an awful lot back. And when they're not giving you an awful lot back, I've had to get used to having like quite really long periods of silence just so that they've got time to think.
Yeah.
And just reassure them that it's okay. I'm just going to give you some time to think about it. Rather than jumping in and going, well, have you tried this?
Yeah.
Sort of thing. But I think it's a fine line at times, because I would never say that I'm a pure coach, as in I will ask people at some point if I feel it's going to be worthwhile, if they want my opinion. Because sometimes people get a little bit stuck.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and reading the situation is really important. So I'm not sure I even buy the concept of pure coach. You know, I think you have to be agile as a coach and work in the moment with people. And sometimes, absolutely, your opinion is what they will really value.
I think that's a really interesting discussion. I'm just enjoying listening to you two talk then. I think there's a couple of things that I heard then that sparking a little bit of learning for me, is that I think as a society and a westernized culture, we have an ingrained belief that the words value and solution are totally synonymous and connected. And as a coach, you can fall into the trap of thinking if people aren't getting solutions, they're not getting value. Yeah. And value comes in many ways. As coaches, my trigger point is if I feel like the coachee is needing to be hurried along, that's my that's my own trigger to go, what's going on for me here? Why am I needing them to rush this? But that's business, right? Isn't it that we're conditioned to think that a solution and a decision is better than staying in a problem for longer? And actually, quite often when you're working in an agile way, the best solutions come out of staying in the problem for longer, not rushing to a solution. And I just wanted to bring it back by that question that I asked you around how coaching has changed. I wonder if there's some connections there, because you said that team coaching was starting to emerge for you before COVID, but then through COVID, it's moved to a more agile model where you're observing or having coaching sessions with small groups of people. Is there anything else that you're seeing at the minute? And dare I ask you, what's your kind of prediction for what form of coaching, given the environment that we're in now, you think will be like growing in popularity or what people need in the next year or two?
That's a really good question. And I think there are some red flags for me actually in terms of where coaching's going. So I'm an associate of two or three different organizations, and one of them spoke to me a couple of months ago about doing 20-minute coaching sessions with people. And I thought, wow, that really is going to drive what am I bringing and what's the solution and how can I add value in 20 minutes.
Those of you that can't see, obviously, because we don't do this podcast as a visual, but John and I's eyes are popping out of our head. Yeah. Just as you said, that strikes a fear in me.
Yeah, and of course, you know,
But you can totally see how somebody as a coaching business is seeing that is a solution that people will buy.
Yeah, and you know.
And for it.
Yeah, absolutely, you know. So I think, I mean, before COVID, before we were all super fluent with Teams and Zoom and all of those vehicles, a colleague of mine used to do quite a lot of telephone coaching, and it was something that I never really engaged with. And that's partly about my personality and wanting to connect with people face to face. What Teams and Zoom have shown us is actually it does work. You know, you can very easily do an hour and a half coaching on Teams, and it's really powerful. The danger then, though, is that you can cram more and more and more into your day as a coach, so you can do more and more and more and more sessions. And I think from an organizational perspective, leaders in L&D and HR are looking at coaching as somebody could go and do 20 minutes with somebody or 30 minutes with somebody. And I'm not sure it really works like that. You know, I'm really not sure it works like that.
No, it sounds too transactional to me, that rather than really getting into putting the coachee at the centre of their coaching. And I think we would all agree that that's where they need to be for it to be effective. But you can understand it in terms of the metrics and the financials around it. But yeah. I agree with you, Sue. I that wouldn't be for me. I mean, it's interesting, really, because we've been running a webinar program with a company. So we've delivered 9 modules, and we've been doing 2 hours a module every fortnight. It's been wonderful from Rachel and I's perspective. We've had some fantastic feedback from the people on the webinar. So some of it's a bit teachy and some of it's a bit, but we've tried to do it in a coaching kind of ethos, if you like. But what's been interesting is we've built up a relationship with each of those people. And there's only been 8 people on the actual webinar, so it's enough for you to have, you know, good contact. What's been interesting is that we have done a few, because there's been like an odd number, we put people into breakout rooms. So I've done a couple of coaching sessions with the person who is the odd one out, if you like.
Yeah.
And Rachel's been doing a fantastic job sort of administrating it all and putting people in breakout rooms and what have you. But those two coaching sessions that I had with 2 different people have been their admission. They were fantastic. They've really, really enjoyed it. So that feels a little bit transactional. Mm. But I don't think it is, because it's in the context of knowing these people over a long period of time. Mm. So understanding what their particular characteristics are and how they think. Mm. So long way around saying it, I think there's a place for it, but like most coaching, I think it needs to be over an extended period of time. So that it allows people to embed the sort of thinking that they're generating when they're being coached.
Mm. I think if we go back to what's coaching about, what's it for, what's the objective? You know, for me, it's almost always some kind of behavioral shift. Mm. Yeah. So can you really even open up a conversation about a behavioral shift in 20 minutes? They weren't saying we want you to do 20 minutes. It was kind of 20 minutes once a month for a period of 6 months. Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. So I'll have 2 hours in a course of 6 months attempting to support people as they go through some sort of behavioral change. I think it's really challenging.
Yeah.
I agree.
And I think it becomes more tell.
Yeah. And I think for those people that are listening that have had coaching, they will know that the issue that you come into the room with is very rarely the big issue. Mm-hmm. And it usually takes a half an hour conversation for the mindset to switch and go, actually, I thought time management was my issue. Mm. But now you've got me thinking, perhaps my issue is I'm not valuing my time on certain things. And then the shift comes from, I haven't got a time management issue, I've got a prioritization issue, or I've got do I value myself? Have I got imposter syndrome? Do I not think I'm enough? Is there a confidence issue? Mm. And that takes you down a whole different path of learning where the paradigm shift happens, which makes the behavior change really easy.
Yeah,
I've been in situations where we've not got to that point till 90 minutes into the session, and and you're literally like, "Wow, we would never have got there."
Mm.
You had to do the conversation first. Mm. So that does. I share that concern, and I share the concern around it's the new, you know. It's just symptomatic of the culture that we live in now. We want immediate solutions. And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And it does frighten me a little bit, because it will create other problems in of itself. Mm-hmm. But you said that there was one thing you'd been asked for that to do. And I asked you, we went off on a tangent then. I said, what mm-hmm. else do you think is emerging for the future, and what would be your prediction? So what else did that spark in you when you were thinking about that?
I think one of the things that, you know, actually I've always brought into my coaching practice, you know, when people ask me, what are you like as a coach? One of the things that I always say is I try and affirm strengths as much as work on development needs. So in my experience, organizations are good at telling people what they're not good at. They are less good at being really clear about what their strengths are. And I think increasingly coaching is around how do we affirm strengths and give people, you used the word confidence before, how do we give people the confidence to work on development needs? So if your strengths are really anchored, it's easy to work on the one or two things that you need to do differently. If your strengths aren't anchored, and then it's all a bit wobbly. So I think increasingly coaching will be about, my phrase, anchoring strengths as much as working on development needs.
Yeah, absolutely. And then this trend that you were talking around in terms of working in more agile ways with teams and organizations, as we move back into the office and not on Zoom so much, do you see that changing the way that coaches work with people face to face as well, perhaps?
I think it's around individual preferences, both from the organizational perspective and the coach's perspective. If I have an opportunity to work with somebody face-to-face versus online, 9 times out of 10, I'll try and do it face-to-face. For a very selfish reason, it gives me more energy. If I'm honest, it gives me much, much more energy. I think from an organizational perspective, from an economic angle, there's a lot to be said about working virtually. So I think there absolutely is a place for it still, even as we all go back into offices. But if I speak from my perspective, the first couple of sessions, I think it's really important to sit in a room with somebody face to face and develop a relationship and look into each other's eyes and have honest conversations.
I'm going to ask you a couple more questions, but more around, we've had quite a coachy chat, but if somebody hasn't had coaching before, what would you say would be the best things to start to cover with a coach? If you haven't had coaching before, why should somebody think, oh, perhaps is that for me, and give it a go?
I think self-awareness is a really beautiful thing. And I actually think it's quite difficult to do, the phrase in my head's assessment, and that's not right. I think it's quite difficult to assess your impact on people without having a conversation with somebody else. So I think coaching is a really powerful way of developing your self-awareness. And actually, at any level in an organization, if you don't have self-awareness, then it's quite hard to self-manage. And if you don't have self-awareness, it's quite difficult to think about what do I need to tune up or tune down in order to have positive relationships with other people. So I think as an into coaching, just thinking about how do I develop my self-awareness and how do I understand the impact that I have on people and what might I need to tune up or tune down is a really easy in to a coaching conversation. Now, inevitably, that will lead you to all kinds of different conversations. But I think that's quite a nice route in.
Yeah, I like that. If somebody is listening to this and thinking, okay, but I think I'm pretty self-aware already, and I think I'm a pretty good manager, leader. I've been doing it for a few years and I'm really busy, a bit too busy for coaching. What would you say to somebody that's got that mindset?
The natural thing in my head is say something about the power of reflection. So it's very easy to get caught up into a cycle where we create habits, some of which are useful, some of which are less useful. So I think I'm a pretty good manager. Okay, well, what do you actually do? What do you bring? How do people experience you? How is that relevant for the context that you're operating in? What might you need to do differently if you wanted to do a bigger, broader role? And so I think I would go to the power of reflection and really being able to pause and just think about behavior and why you do things and what drives that. And, you know, it's a bit like what you were saying before about, you know, often the first thing that people come in and talk about isn't the thing that they really need to talk about.
Yeah.
So,
I'm thinking when you're saying that is, I see this in men more than women for reasons we'll all understand, is that we tend to become the stories John's laughing. We tend to become the stories that we tell ourselves. And that story of I'm a pretty good manager, you only look for evidence that reinforces that you're a good manager. And you only employ people or you work best with people that work to your style. Now, if you wanted a bigger or better role, you are inevitably going to come up against people that don't work with your style, but all you've done is reinforce your style the whole time. And that's quite a powerful conversation.
Well, and I think there are two, three things in my head, just listening to you and responding to that. One is you know, in coaching conversations, I often get into a place where I find myself saying, what made you successful in the past won't make you successful in the future. And, you know, and I think increasingly leaders understand that. I think that concept is more accessible now probably than it's been before. I think what made people successful when they were more junior in their career is typically how hard do they work and how credible are they? As you become more senior, those things are still there and are still important. But what also becomes disproportionately important is how do you impact and influence and what's your reach? Who do you know and how do you use that network? And those are just different skills, different paradigms that people are having to kind of grapple with.
Yeah. To add to that as well, I think it's increasingly how you make decisions and how you justify your decisions. That's a very different skill, and how you communicate the decision that you've made. Mm. More question on this track. Another barrier that we may come up with when somebody's, say, a mid-senior level leader is coaching sounds awesome, but I don't have time for it, or I'll do it next month, the rolling next month, you know, the rolling next year. What's your view on that, or response to that when you come up against that?
Well, I think you can take a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. So I think the best coaching relationships that I've had have been when people are open to it. And obviously not everybody comes with the same level of enthusiasm, but if people are there because they feel they need to be there, or they're told that they have to be there, or there is some kind of perceived downside of not doing it, then it isn't a write-off, but it takes longer for the coach to build the relationship to get into quality conversations. Sometimes it's just not the right time for people to do coaching, and that's actually okay. But what I would say is, coaching is a way of learning, and why would anybody not want to learn? So, you know, if we think about kind of traditional competency frameworks, there never used to be anything around learning agility. Whenever you look at a competency framework now, in almost any organization, there's something about learning agility and, you know, the ability to adapt and be agile and flex. And coaching is a way of really helping you do that. So I think if people are saying, it all sounds great, but it's not for me right now, okay, that might be the case. I think a challenge is around learning, and, you know, is learning something that's important to you?
I agree with everything you say there, Sue. And it makes me think about it's whether you're curious enough about what the choices that might be open to me. Why would I just shut off that particular route to learning, as you say, simply because I haven't got the time? And then in a way, it's almost a circular argument, because that is the whole self-awareness bit, isn't it? It's that whole ability to reflect on, well, maybe this could happen. And having like a positive view, if you were coming to coaching because you felt like you needed that other person to talk to, you needed somebody to bounce your ideas off. But if you think, and I think this is where you were sort of coming from, Rachel, I'm guessing, is that if you think that you've got it all, and you know you are the finished article, and there are lots of people that we all know that are out there, then you'll never have that curiosity. So, you know, I would say no, coaching's probably not for somebody like that, because they'd never come to it anyway, ever.
I suppose the other thing that I would say is, with those people who, you know, see themselves as the finished article, or say, it all sounds great, but not now. My response to that as a coach would be to make the coaching objectives very concrete and very tangible and get some short-term wins. Okay, you know, if I could support you on one thing, what would it be? Mm. And so make it very kind of finite. I think one of the...
A bit narrower,
yeah. So that you can actually make a difference and demonstrate yeah. impact.
And they could then see that.
And they could see that. Then, you know, there's a hook. There's a hook.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think was apparent in the 90s maybe and the 2000s was coaching almost became people having what I call an executive ally. And I fell into, do you know what? I fell into this too. So let me not pretend that I didn't do that. So I worked with a CEO of a recruitment consultancy as a coach over a really long period of time. And when I look back at that, I realize I had become his executive ally rather than his coach. I was somebody that he could bounce ideas off. I was somebody that understood his organization, understood his team. And it was useful for him, but it wasn't coaching.
I think that's Sue, you mentioned though, you were doing half coaching, half consultancy. That was a consultant under the guise of a coach, perhaps.
But I think he saw it as I was his executive coach. And I think it still happens now. I think, you know, I'm working with an organization at the moment where the CEO has a coach who he's worked with for 5 years. Okay, well, what are the behavioral shifts that you're working on? I think it's a very, very different concept.
It's really interesting, though, isn't it? Because those people that you're talking about there, Sue, they still found value in what you were doing. You're looking back at it now saying, well, I probably thought at the time I was being the coach, but I'm looking back and reflecting on it as you would do as a coach.
Yeah.
Go, well, actually, no, I wasn't coaching. But nevertheless, they found value in it.
Yeah, no, and I think there is. I think the more senior you get in organisations, the lonelier it becomes.
Yeah.
And why would you not need an executive ally from time to time?
Yeah. Who's independent, you know, doesn't have
absolutely.
That organisational pull, yeah?
Absolutely. But let's be real about it and let's
call it what it is.
Call it what it is rather than, you know,
an
executive coach. If you were to change that narrative around in that coaching example with that CEO, if that CEO were to have the same therapist for 5 years, you would be saying that that was a positive relationship, would you? Yeah. You'd be saying there's a dependency there.
Yeah, and that's not
learning.
Yeah, of course.
And I do think that's an interesting question to ask. Yeah, another question around the coaching is, what are the most common topics that people come to you for coaching on?
Well, the big one that absolutely stands out is, how do I manage upwards? You know, I might be the finished article in terms of leading my team, but how do I manage upwards in this complex matrix environment? That for me has always been... I've always heard people talk about that. And that plays back a bit to what I said about what made people successful earlier in their career versus later in the career. It isn't just about working hard and being credible. It's about being more intentional about how you influence. So definitely something about managing upwards. I think people come to me as a coach trying to figure out what's next for them, what do they want to do, which kind of plays into all of that stuff about what are my strengths, what do I need to work on, what gives me energy, what drains me of energy. how do I balance work and life, and, you know, kind of what's next for me. That's quite often conversations that I have. And then I suppose the other thing, and I'm thinking out loud here, is, and they may not present it with this language, but how do I engage my team? How do I, you know, increasingly larger organizations, global organizations are matrixed, and we're working, you know, with people who come from really different backgrounds to ourselves. How do I engage and how do I build a team in complex matrix organizations? And actually, that doesn't need to be global. You know, one of the calls I had yesterday is working with quite a small team, and we're doing an offsite next week. And, you know, they're trying to work in a more collaborative, horizontal way, in a less hierarchical way. And that's difficult for people to navigate because they like clarity.
Yeah, I think that's ever increasing, isn't it? The uncertainty is always increasing, and hierarchy and being able to see org charts and reporting lines makes people feel certain. But the thinking and work that's required today, the leaders at the top just don't have the time to be able to make that many decisions or be across everything. And it is requiring people to work in different ways and to be okay with uncertainty at different levels. And I think that ladders nicely into what you were saying, why coaching is not reserved so much for the executive level now, because people lower down the organizations are experiencing just as much uncertainty as people very senior in the organization.
And I think that's where the problem can kick in when it comes to spending money on it, Rachel. I think you probably agree with this. So, you know, that if you come further down the organization, it's like, oh, can they justify being able to spend enough time with a coach to help people resolve some of those issues, and therefore leads back to, well, we'll do 20 minute sessions because that's affordable. And then, so then the investment starts leading the learning. And I always think that that becomes a bit dangerous then, because then you're getting into all sorts of people jumping on the bandwagon and saying, well, I can deliver these 20 minute sessions. I can do 10 of them in the morning, you know,
of course.
You know, absolutely. And you know, and I know, the three of us know, if you do a really, really good coaching session, you're pretty knackered after, as the coach. And people go, I mean, my friends say to me, how on earth can you just be tired, like having had an hour and a half conversation with this? Because literally, my brain's thinking really hard, and we know it's a, you know, it's not a very efficient piece of kit. So
it's an active sport, isn't it? It's an active sport, really listening with the intention to understand. And holding that person through an hour and a half is an active sport.
Just for the benefit of our listeners here, Sue's got sort of both her hands up and cupped, and it is about that, isn't it? It's like holding the conversation, but also holding your own thoughts about it, and earlier, going back to what we talked about earlier on, about stopping yourself from sort of jumping in and going, right, what's the best question?
That brings us really nicely back to possibly one of the biggest leadership challenges of this next generation, is it's the skill to stay in the middle. We are so conditioned to want in a yes or no, or right or wrong. These people are good, these people are bad. This is black, this is white. We want news in like 140 characters.
Certainty, but Rachel,
to stay in the middle, to listen with intent, to listen to not both sides, to every side, and to reserve judgment for long enough to let everybody be heard is exhausting. And we aren't rewarded for that in this society at the minute, but I think that's where, when information is ever present, that's the skill of the future. And I think that's really where the role of coaching will come into fruition. I am heartened by the organizations reacting and becoming more open to team coaching and agile coaching with groups, like you said. So we've definitely, you know, I've only been coaching for since 2015. John, you've been doing it a lot longer than me. But I kind of started in the end of where it was a coaching session. All my work was coaching sessions. And I only did it like that for 2 years, and it changed very quickly to group or team coaching, or with a little bit of training and learning embedded in it and reflection time. And it is about adapting, isn't it, as a coach to what works. I still love the conversations, and I do love it when organisations invest in that. But I think we all have to be realistic to it has to move as well with how teams work, and it's balancing that as well.
Mm. Yeah, and we are living in a different world now. You know, we are living in this hybrid world where, you know, the rules of engagement have fundamentally changed. And I don't think that's different for coaching. I think it has fundamentally changed, and we need to respond to that and roll with that. At the same time, though, cherishing those opportunities where you can sit with somebody for an hour and a half or 2 hours and be completely on their agenda, you know, that really is a gift.
Oh, it's the biggest gift. Mm. I had an intro session with somebody the other day, and she'd never had coaching. I mean, this is amazing. It's a global construction company, and this lady is only a month into the role, the organisation, and they've said, would you like coaching to transition into this role? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an amazing organisation. And she said, you know, I don't know whether I need it or not. And I said, well, when is anybody ever going to give you the gift of talking about yourself for an hour and a half? Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it? It's an amazing gift if somebody can give it to you. Any more coaching conversations, John, before we move on to talking about Sue?
No, I mean, I've really, really been grateful for you coming on today, Sue. One of the things that we ask all, I guess, is what three leadership essentials jump out at you? So you've coached lots and lots of people. You've coached lots of people in teams. You've been at all sorts of levels in the organization. So you've obviously seen lots of leadership traits. Mm. What are your three leadership essentials?
Mm. I've thought long and hard about this. And like you say, I've seen all kinds of different leaders in all kinds of different contexts. And so when I thought about this, I reflected on who has had the biggest impact on me. And I literally thought about two or three different characters. So my first one, and maybe I would say this because I'm a coach and I've kind of probably already alluded to it, but it's humility. I think it's an underrated leadership quality. You know, typically the charismatic, extroverted leaders stand out, maybe earlier, even on graduate schemes, earlier in their careers. But the people with humility who have the ability to be open, to ask for help, to not position themselves as the finished article, for me, can be really, really powerful leaders. But I do think it's an underrated virtue. I think, secondly, the ability to connect. People can get better at that. People behaviorally can get better at listening and being curious. And, you know, there's a mindset thing about taking the time to connect with people. But when it's really authentic, it's really powerful, you know. And I think really strong leaders, you want to be in their sunshine for a little while because of that power of the connection. So it sounds very simple, but being able to connect on a human level with people, for me, is a really vital leadership component. And then the third thing is the courage to say we've got this wrong. So I talked earlier in this session around I'm doing some work with an energy company, and a really senior executive came onto that program and was asked a similar question, actually, about, you know, leadership tips, I think it was kind of framed. And one of his responses was the courage to say no, the courage to say we've got it wrong, the courage to stop projects, even when they, you know, there may have been millions of pounds worth of investment, that ability to take a helicopter view, weigh up the pros and cons and say, do you know what, we need to cut our losses on this one. Or this isn't working, or you know, sometimes that person isn't working in that role, but the courage to kind of spot when things aren't working and take action.
They're really good ones, really good ones, and very unique, actually. I don't think we've ever had the humility one, and we ask everybody this, so it's really interesting to get your coaching view on that.
Humility for me is important in that the experience I have of when somebody brings humility is it makes me want to step towards them rather than step away from them. And why would you not want that as a leader? But I think there's a paradox in terms of humble people don't stand out in organizations. It's the more charismatic ones that stand out. So how do organizations manage that paradox? And reward, well, identify and reward humility.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because the last year or two where there's been more crises in business than ever before, I think humility is a trait that stands better in testing times.
Yeah.
The charismatic leaders tend to not be able to read the room as well.
Yeah. But I think it's interesting in that, you know, one of the phrases in leadership speak over the last few years is about vulnerability and showing your vulnerability. And I'm not against that. I think, you know, that can be a really powerful thing. But I also think it can come across as completely inauthentic. So people who bring humility are okay with their vulnerability anyway. You know, they're okay in not positioning themselves as the finished article. You know, I've experienced too many leaders who've been on some kind of program and suddenly feel the need to tell their own story and demonstrate their vulnerability. And it really doesn't land as authentic. So it doesn't have the same impact as people who genuinely have a deeper mindset, stroke value, stroke motive around personal humility.
Yeah, I mean, I'm no wordsmith at all, but I'm just thinking about the word humility, and the word that keeps coming into my head alongside it is human.
Yeah.
And it's that ability to be human. And like you say, Sue, authentically, that shines through immediately, doesn't it? And what is it about that quality that draws people in? Because it literally does. You would follow, we talk about followers a lot in terms of leadership, but you would follow that person wherever they went, because you truly believe that you had, and I think you've lined those up very nice, you had connection. And a lot of that connection, that humility, probably gives you the courage to do the things and be vulnerable and lead in an authentic way. So I really love those. Yeah, they go together very well.
And just before we wrap up, there's a question coming to my mind around, you've been doing this for a long time, Sue. You've spoken really eloquently on the podcast. And I think there's... you know, everybody tends to ask, you know, how do you do all this? Like, how does this show up in your life? Have you got this nailed? What does the work look like for somebody that is running a coaching business? So tell us a little bit more about you. How do you hold up these boundaries? How do you live your life? How do you role model this? And how do you get it wrong and learn?
So as a coach, I have a coach. and that works really well for me in terms of keeping me honest. I have worked with coaching supervisors over the years who have actually challenged me in terms of what do I, so my coach is about my own personal development. The coaching supervisor is about my coaching practice. And I think it's really easy as a coach not to do that, because it's an investment, because it takes time. But it's really been incredibly valuable for me from a learning perspective, but also in terms of sort of evolving how I work as a coach. I think humility, I would always say to coaching clients or any clients that I was working with, I'm really happy to talk about what I bring and what I don't bring. I'm really happy to talk about what are likely to, how they will likely experience my strengths and how they might experience some of the things that I'm not as good at. And I think when that works really well with clients, then they learn to really value the strengths and mitigate against the development needs. So I'm working with an HR director now who is a really strong J on Myers-Briggs. So for the people who know Myers-Briggs, they'll know what that means. If you don't, it's she likes to live her life in a structured, organized way. She likes closure. She likes lists. She likes preciseness. I'm the exact opposite of that. I'd much rather keep things fluid. I'd much rather keep things open. That's not to say I can't plan, but it doesn't give me any energy. So when we first started working together, you know, we were actually designing a program, and she said things to me like, what are we going to do at 10 o'clock? And I would be kind of talking big picture, and she would be saying, yeah, but what are we going to do at 10 o'clock? And, you know, through the process of working together and through the process of being open around, you know what, this isn't my preference. I think I can really see your need for it. This isn't something that I'm good at. You get a richer relationship, and you get a deeper level of trust, and you come to value the things that you bring, and you can compensate for the things that you don't bring. It's a bit of a rambling answer, I think, to what you were saying, but
No, that makes a lot of sense. And how does that show up to you in business? You know, a lot of entrepreneurs kind of like this kind of material. They like to do the work on themselves and have to be self-aware, because you get it wrong a lot more than you get it right. And that's how you learn. But how do you use this in terms of how you run your business and grow as an entrepreneur as well?
Well, I think the first thing that's in my head is that piece about being able to genuinely connect with people is something that A, I think I can do, and B, I've always actively invested time in. And that served me really well as an entrepreneur. It's funny because entrepreneur doesn't kind of sit neatly with me, but other people probably say I'm an entrepreneur. I think really seeking to engage and build networks, not in a I need to network kind of way, but in a very genuine, interested way, has always served me well as somebody who runs their own business. So, you know, clients have moved around different organizations and have taken me with them. Yeah. Yes, that's because I'm good at what I do, but it's also because I make them look good, and it's also because they enjoy working with me. Somebody very wise, years and years ago, when I still had a corporate career and I was thinking about doing this, I did a program with a company called Shepherd Moscow, who work at quite a deep level on personal change. And it was a kind of a consulting skills program. And we were in small groups and we had to go and interview a client. It was a kind of a diagnostic interview. We had to go and find out about their business. And we went in and we thought we'd asked really good questions, and we came out and we were all feeling quite smug. And the person who was an actor came out, and his feedback for our group was, it was like being interviewed by the Gestapo. And I was like, oh my God. But he was right, because I'd forgotten to build the relationship. I thought that I was there to demonstrate how clever I was and ask great questions. And the words, I couldn't tell you his name, but I remember he said, it was like being interviewed by the Gestapo. And the second thing he said is, you need to remember, people will work with people that they like working with. And I think that's always really served me well. Mm. Yeah, I'm actually interested in what I do. I really enjoy what I do, and that's lucky. But I really do invest time in building those relationships and connecting as a human.
What about the boundary word? How do you keep set your own boundaries, and how often do you set them? And how do you hold yourself against them? Because work-life balance when you work for yourself can be really difficult to maintain. It's certainly something I struggle with.
Well, what I would say is I'm much better at managing boundaries now than I was. And I think it's a lifelong process of learning managing boundaries. You know, being really clear about what you're trading off is something that I think a lot of people find very difficult. So I think contracting around how you'll work together in any kind of assignment is really, really important, because then you're not letting anybody down, not least yourself, in terms of what you bring to a relationship. You know, in my earlier life, I was something of a people pleaser, and you know, my boundaries were really muddied. You know, if I just work a bit harder on this, I'll crack it, or you know, if I just take a bit longer with this person, then you know, it doesn't matter. And actually it does matter. You know, managing your boundaries is incredibly important, and I think it's a lifelong kind of challenge.
I think before we were chatting, before we started this this podcast, you said something really poignant that I wrote down, that you said set your own expectations around what is enough. Talk to us about that.
When you work as an executive coach, let me talk about me. When I've worked as an executive coach, I've worked with lots of people who realize that they haven't managed their boundaries well and that their work-life balance is completely screwed. And, you know, there were points in my career where, you know, I set up a business with three colleagues, and there was a gap in the market, and there was an opportunity to build a kind of a niche coaching business. And quite early on, I realized that the cost for me was going to be too great, and that all of the stuff that I was working with clients in terms of work-life balance was suddenly going to be me. That business was really successful. They went on and sold it to a big consulting firm. And I was really happy for them, but I made the right decision, because I had that great work-life balance, and what's enough? You know, if I'd gone on to earn an extra however many thousands of pounds, would that have made me happier? Probably not.
And would have probably come at some sort of cost as well.
I think it would have come at a huge personal cost. You know, I'm married, I've got two great daughters. Had I gone down that route, A, I'm not sure I'd still be married, and B, I'm certain that I wouldn't have the same relationship with them as I had. Mm-hmm. You know, before we came on this podcast, I heard myself, you know, kind of saying that piece about, you know, one of the joys for me around working for myself and collaborating with bright people, be they clients or be they associates, is, you know, being able to kind of navigate my own path. And I think I'd probably be unemployable now in a kind of a corporate environment. I want to work more in the winter and less in the summer. I want to work on interesting projects with interesting clients that give me energy. And, you know, I want to work with bright people. And because I do this for myself, I'm not always able to fulfill all of those criteria, but 9 times out of 10, I am. And when I get to that point where I realize that something's good for the coffers but bad for the soul, I'm doing it consciously rather than just drifting into it.
And that's positive role modeling, isn't it? I suppose you are in a privileged position where you are, when you are dealing with people at that executive level, there's not many of them that you're not coaching on in some way, shape or form around work-life balance at some point, or a relationship that's gone sour because of, be it with their partner or their kids, because of work decisions. So you are in a privileged position where you're seeing that and thinking that could be me. Yeah. So that you, and then you have to role model the boundaries that you're coaching the client on.
Yeah, and I'm really happy to share that story. You know, it was a really painful experience in that I told all my clients I was now going to be something else. And then 6 months later, it's like, oh, no, you know, I'm not doing that anymore. But it was absolutely the right thing. It was absolutely the right thing for me. I joke sometimes that one day I'm going to write a book about the people who get to the top of organizations aren't the most talented or the most gifted. They're just the ones who are prepared to sacrifice the most. So, you know, be really clear about what you're prepared to sacrifice. Don't drift into that. Be really clear about it.
Yeah, that is a very lovely and powerful note that I think we'll have a lot of people thinking on, and is a very poignant place to end. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've really enjoyed this conversation. If people are thinking, whoa, this sounds awesome, where can they find out a little bit more about Sue Baker? What's your web address? How would they get hold of you?
Contact me on LinkedIn, Sue Baker Consulting. You'll find me on LinkedIn. And I'd be really happy to have conversations with anybody.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much. It's been an absolute privilege to really enjoy this. Thank you.
Me too. It's gone very quickly.
Thank you. Very much enjoyed that, and quite a lot to reflect on.
Thank you so much for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you've got a lot out of this. If you'd like to read up a bit more on any of the content that you've heard in today's podcast, be sure to check out our website, scaffoldcoaching.com.